WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two of today's most important jazz guitarists, Jim Hall and Pat Metheny, compare notes about music. They have a new CD of duets. It's the coming together of two different generations and two different approaches to the instrument. And music critic Milo Miles reviews the work of Brazilian singer Caetano Veloso, who's currently on tour in the U.S. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate is scheduled to vote tomorrow on two partisan versions of a patient's Bill of Rights. Today, Republicans refused to widen the scope of their version, a move that would have covered more Americans. The GOP did, however, agree to require health insurers to cover the cost of hospital stays for mastectomies. Tomorrow's major vote is expected to come on a Democratic amendment that would allow patients to sue their health maintenance organizations and collect damages if they're denied treatment. Republicans are strongly opposed to that proposal, saying it would drive up health care costs. A top UN war crimes prosecutor is in Kosovo to examine alleged mass grave sites. Jennifer Glass reports on Louise Arbour's visit to Selina.
Louise Arbour says she is confident that the evidence being gathered in Kosovo will eventually be used to bring those responsible to justice. She's seen a number of mass grave sites, including one here in Selina, that had contained 21 bodies, most shot at close range, six of them children under the age of 10. Kosovo's children, Arbour says, must not forget what has happened here.
Even if it was only that, I think it would be worth every effort that we're putting into it. To record the story for the benefit of these children. But there's more to it than that. I think it is a process of accountability, and we will put it to that use.
Arbour says the evidence gathered so far is compelling and adds a visual element to the hundreds of refugee accounts she's read of the atrocities that have taken place in Kosovo. Jennifer Glass, NPR News, Selina.
President Clinton took a swipe at George W. Bush today. In a speech to the centrist Democratic Leadership Council, a group Mr. Clinton helped found in the late 1980s, the president mocked Bush's claim to represent a new compassionate conservatism. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Democratic Leadership Council developed Clinton's New Democrat philosophy. He calls it the Third Way, a break from both conservative and liberal doctrines. But now the DLC believes it's been robbed, rhetorically at least, by George W. Bush's claims to be a compassionate conservative, something that the president said sounds a lot like being a New Democrat.
This compassionate conservatism has a great ring to it, you know. It sounds so good. And I've really worked hard to try to figure out what it means. I mean, I made an honest effort. And near as I can tell, here's what it means. It means I like you. I do.
This is the first time the president has directly attacked Bush. Bush's spokeswoman said it was amazing that the incumbent president took time out of his busy schedule to talk about the campaign of a candidate who isn't even the Republican nominee. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost 26 points to close at 11,148, but advancing issues led declines in moderate trading. This is NPR. Prosecutors in Los Angeles have asked a judge to refuse bail or to set a high bail amount for a woman accused of belonging to the terrorist Symbionese Liberation Army in the 1970s. Prosecutors say Kathleen Celaya had been a fugitive for more than 20 years and is at risk to try to escape again. Celaya is accused of planting pipe bombs under two police cars in the mid-1970s. She's been living in Minnesota for the past 23 years under an assumed name with her husband and three daughters. For the first time, an Israeli Arab has been named to the legislature's very sensitive Committee on Defense and Foreign Policy. Mike O'Connor reports from Jerusalem.
Hassem Mohammed is an Arab, a Palestinian, who is also an Israeli citizen. There are about a million Arabs who live in Israel, as opposed to the occupied territories, and they are citizens of Israel. They say they are victims of deeply ingrained racism, and many Israelis, along with the UN, agree. There are 10 Arabs in the legislature, but until Mohammed's appointment today, none in important positions. But by putting Mohammed on the Defense and Foreign Affairs Committee, the leadership of the legislature has brought attacks from the political right, which says he will compromise the country's security because his true allegiance is with the Palestinians, not with Israel. The committee gets reports on military and intelligence operations. Mohammed said he was elected by citizens of Israel and has a right to be on any legislative committee. For NPR News, I'm Mike O'Connor in Jerusalem.
Representative John Kasich said today that he won't continue his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. The Ohio congressman threw his support to Texas Governor George W. Bush. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jim Hall is the favorite guitarist of many jazz musicians and listeners. For example, he's always been one of guitarist Pat Metheny's favorites. Metheny counts Hall as one of his greatest influences. Metheny has a big following among jazz and rock fans, and like Hall, has won many jazz polls. Now Hall and Metheny have collaborated on a new CD of duets. It's the coming together of two different generations and styles. Hall started recording in the 50s, Metheny in the late 70s. Metheny has used synthesizers and other electronics to alter his sound, whereas Hall describes himself as still in the kerosene age, just a man, a guitar, and an amp. We invited Jim Hall and Pat Metheny to join us and compare notes on their development as guitarists. Let's start with a track from their new CD. This is a Jim Hall composition called Looking Up. Music from the new CD, Jim Hall and Pat Metheny. Jim Hall and Pat Metheny, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Thanks, Terry. Great to be here.
Well, Pat Metheny, you grew up with rock and roll, and I'm wondering if that affected your idea of guitar playing and guitar amplification. I'm presuming you grew up with rock and roll. I might be wrong.
Well, you know, it's funny. My case is a little odd. Yes, I did kind of get interested in the guitar at age 8 or 9, you know, like millions of other kids, largely due to the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show and that whole phenomenon that happened at that time. The odd thing in my case is that within a matter of weeks after getting a guitar, my older brother Mike brought home a Miles Davis record, Four and More, and that changed my life immediately. And it wasn't a gradual thing for me. It was sort of like an on-off switch that got switched. Mm. And I became probably the world's youngest jazz snob. I mean, by age 12, all I wanted to listen to was Train and Miles and Sonny Rollins right. and Jim and Bill Evans and those records, and continued that way until I was 18 or 19 years old and started playing with Gary Burton, whose band, you know, was messing around with things outside of just the straight up and down jazz, you know, tradition or whatever you'd want to call it. And it was kind of at that point that I became more kind of interested in kind of the other stuff that the guitar could do.
It's funny, I mean, like Jim Hall, when you were growing up, the popular music was jazz, right?
In a certain sense, it was. There were these marvelous big bands around, which were, the musicianship level was really high, and they were also popular mm-hmm. with the public, I think largely because people could dance to them. So yeah, that was popular, and but there, I'm sure there were tons of garbage around.
There always is.
Yeah, there always exactly. People don't change that much. But my kind of spiritual awakening was when I heard Charlie Christian on a record with Benny Goodman Sextet. And I'd say this a lot, but I didn't really know what he... I had been playing about 3 years in little groups, and I didn't know what Charlie Christian was doing, but I said, that's great. I wish I could do that. And I still say the same thing.
Well, I want to play another track from your new duet CD, Jim Hall, Pat Metheny. And Pat Metheny, I'm going to ask you to choose a track. I know that you, that Jim Hall has been one of the greatest influences on your playing, particularly when you were young and coming of age. I'm going to ask you to choose a track from the CD that you particularly like for Jim Hall's playing.
I think I'd pick the track Falling Grace. I mean, I love the way Jim plays on this whole record. It's actually, there's so many things that Jim does so beautifully. And one of them is his ability to accompany people is really sort of off the scale great. And he always plays these brilliant solos, but there's some stuff that he does when he plays behind people that is absolutely singular. There's just nothing like it. And he really has this link to like Freddie Green and that way of playing rhythm that is just about not around anymore. And yet at the same time, it's very modern what he does. And the way he plays a beautiful solo too, but the accompanying parts that he plays, you know, when I'm playing the melody on this track, just kill me every time.
Okay, so this is Falling Grace from the Jim Hall Pat Metheny duet record. It's Jim Hall and Pat Metheny from their new duet record on Telarc Jazz. How did you guys both meet?
I like to tell this story, so I'm going to jump in here.
Okay.
Pat was a juvenile delinquent. He had taken leave of home for a short while, and he came to New York, and he was with our mutual friend, whom we just lost, Attila Zoller. And I was playing in a club called The Guitar. I was working with Ron Carter, and Attila brought this kid in with braces on his teeth, and I think you were 15, Pat,
yeah.
And introduced him to Jane, my wife, and I, and me, and that's how we met, and I think Attila was kind of taking Pat around New York. He had heard Freddie Hubbard and Bill Evans' trio, So I became aware of him then, and Attila said, this kid is terrific, man. Attila was from Hungary. That's my Hungarian accent. And then I noticed Pat. I started to pay attention when he joined Gary Burton's group. So I've known him that long.
Yeah, we go back a ways. And, of course, for me, just hearing Jim that trip live, that would have been in 1971, was just kind of a revelation for me. Of course, I already loved Jim's playing from records, but seeing him, we actually went, I think, five nights in a row. You
guys
were playing.
I forgot.
We went every night to hear y'all. It was really the best music I had ever heard come from a guitar. And to this day, I have memories, flashbacks of that gig. I mean, it was so fresh, what Jim and Ron were playing together. And, you know, so he was already my hero, but he became doubly my hero from that experience. And we kind of stayed in touch over the years, yeah. You know, when I kind of moved, you know, up to the, you know, East Coast area. You know, we'd see each other here and there. And
we played a concert in 82, I think, together, right?
That's right, at City College in New York. And then we did a little tour in France a few years later, or I guess in the late 80s or early 90s, something like that. And we always talked about maybe, you know, playing together, you know, on a record or something, because I think we always had a real natural, easy rapport as players. It was always fun and easy for us to play together. And I think we always really responded to the way we listened to each other as players, too, which is, for me, just the thing that I always look for in somebody that I really want to, like, make a record with or play with that much. I mean, it sort of went beyond, for me, the point, well, Jim is my favorite guitar player and all that. It went to another thing of, like, well, we play good together and we can make music together in a natural, easy kind of way.
My guests are guitarist Pat Metheny and Jim Hall. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are guitarists Jim Hall and Pat Metheny. They have a new CD of duets. Jim Hall, I'm going to ask you to choose a track from your new duet record with Pat Metheny that you think really shows off his playing.
Well, I like... there's two choices, actually. Summertime, but Pat just plays rhythm on it, but it's so amazing. I just sort of float over the rhythm. That's one. The other is Farmer's Trust, which is Pat's tune, which I love. It's a lovely tune. So I would say between those two, or both.
Well, you're going to have to choose one.
Okay,
so Farmer's Trust. Rules of the game.
Okay, Farmer's Trust.
Okay, we'll play Farmer's Trust. Why did you choose it?
I chose it because I love the tune. I like the title. It's kind of a play on words. The Farmer's Trust is a bank, I believe, right?
In
your hometown.
Yeah, it used to be a bank in East
Summer, yeah. So it has kind of a mixed message, and it's a lovely tune, and I enjoyed playing the melody on it, and I love the way Pat plays on it.
Okay, and this is from the new duet record featuring Jim Hall and Pat Metheny. Jim Hall and Pat Metheny from their new CD of duets. You each started performing in different decades. Jim Hall, you started, I think, in the 50s. Pat Metheny, you in the 70s. I'd like you each to describe what the jazz scene was like, what the performance venues were like when you first started performing. Jim Hall, you want to start?
I like the term venue. My first venue was Molly's Bar in Cleveland, Ohio, with kind of sawdust on the floor, I think. But I was 13 then. You couldn't really call that the jazz scene. That's a lovely euphemism, venue. I like that. It's a little difficult for me to say because I was, first of all, I was incredibly lucky. My first sort of, I guess you'd say, big-time job after I got out of music school was with Chico Hamilton, and I was meeting all my heroes and occasionally getting to play with them. So I didn't really care where we played. We played in some, mostly nightclubs. The idea of a concert was kind of rare for us. It was mostly, Duke Ellington had done some concert things and people like that. But, and then gradually the jazz festivals started to show up, like the Newport Jazz Festival. I remember when that started, and the Monterey Festival. But there were just a handful, and there was, I felt anyway, almost nothing in terms of Europe, unless you lived in Paris or something like that. But now I think I spend more time in Europe and Japan than I do playing, than I do in the States. So it was quite different in that way. It's still tons of fun for me, and it was fun then.
Did you have any sense when you were getting started of what the jazz life was supposed to be or what you wanted it to be?
I had a junior high school principal who called me into his office one day, and he said, sort of to tell me the facts of life. And he said I was going to be a jazz musician, and then I went someplace and I saw the way those guys lived, and I said no. And I thought, good luck. Now you're a junior high school principal. What's so great about that? I didn't really know. I just knew that, the music just kind of took me over, and mm-hmm. I felt instantly that I had joined a family. It cuts across all kinds of boundaries, ethnic boundaries, gender boundaries, age boundaries, all the boundaries that people make, and I loved that, and it was just great, and still is.
Pat Metheny, what was like the jazz scene like when you started playing in the 70s, and what did you expect of the jazz life?
I was very lucky to grow up close to Kansas City. I'm from a little town in Missouri called Lee Summit, Missouri, that's, within driving distance of Kansas City, where at that time there was a very active jazz scene, as there remains to this day. I mean, there's so many good players in Kansas City that, for a city of its size, it's I don't know that I've ever seen any place quite like that. The lucky part for me is that there were very few guitar players. So starting from the time I was about 14 or 15, I was able to start working with a lot of the best musicians in town and continue doing that until I, got out of school and moved away. So that was really my training ground, which was it was fortunate for me because it wasn't a theoretical thing. It wasn't in the environment of a jazz education program or something like that. I mean, I really learned how to play by playing with guys who were much older and much better than me. And, I was just lucky to be in that situation, and it's helped me ever since. And that continued shortly after I got out of school. I, as I mentioned before, began playing in Gary Burton's group, which was a fantastic band with Steve Swallow playing bass and Bob Moses playing drums. And, I played with them for 3 years and started, making records and everything like that. And then got to start my own band when I was like 21 or 22 years old. And that's kind of when, it was sort of like cold water getting dropped over your head. I mean, being a band leader and traveling around, the way we did, which was roughly 250 to 300 gigs a year for 12 or 15 years, which is sort of that's about how long that tour lasted, was really a whole different thing, you know. And I guess I didn't really have an image in my mind of what it would be like. All I knew and know to this day, it's sort of like what Jim was saying, is that I feel so glad that I'm, you know, just a member of this community of musicians that is so special that, you know, it's a way of living your life that it's just the greatest. I mean, you know, we get to play for people who actually like the music and I've been able to play with a lot of the best musicians on earth, some of whom were musicians that are real heroes for me. So, I mean, you're not going to hear any complaints from the guitar department over here.
Yeah, same here.
Pat Metheny, this might be a good time for me to pick up on something that Jim Hall said earlier when he was describing how you both met. He said that you were a juvenile delinquent who had temporarily left home. Was that an accurate description?
Well, that may be a little bit exaggerated. I'm sure if my parents are listening, they wouldn't hear it quite like that.
He's now, an adult delinquent now.
Yeah, I'm still slightly delinquent. I don't know about juvenile anymore, but... No, I was actually, in fact, very serious about music at a very young age, which caused people to really be concerned about me, probably with good reason as I look back on it now. You know, I was, you know, you could almost say obsessed with the idea of learning about music and particularly jazz to the point where I would practice, you know, 12, 15 hours a day for weeks on end, just trying to come to grips with the language of music, particularly bebop, which... I don't know any other way you can do it. I mean, it's hard on any instrument. On the guitar, it's nearly impossible to really deal with that vocabulary. And I guess everybody was just worried about me because I was also not studying math or history or anything like that. I was just practicing all the time. So I guess that's where my juvenile delinquent reputation comes from.
But you weren't running around the street with switchblade knives, on the other hand.
No, just guitar picks.
Well, we took them off the street and got them a guitar, and look what happened. It should be a lesson to all of us.
Jim Hall and Pat Metheny have a new CD of duets on Telarc Jazz. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publishers of War of the Rats by David L. Robbins, a novel about the World War II battle in Stalingrad, available in hardcover. And from Vizix. Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with guitarist Jim Hall and Pat Metheny. And music critic Milo Miles discusses Brazilian pop singer Caetano Veloso, who is currently performing in the U.S. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with guitarists Jim Hall and Pat Metheny. They have a new CD of duets. It's the coming together of two different generations and two different approaches to the instrument. Hall started recording in the 50s, Metheny in the late 70s. Metheny has used synthesizers and other electronics to alter his sound. Hall just has his amp. Now, you've both done your share in kind of expanding what a guitar does. And I would like you to each talk a little bit about what was expected of a guitarist when you started performing. You know, what did other people assume that the guitarist's role in the band was supposed to be? Jim Hall, let's start with you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I probably inferred out of guilt and that sort of stuff that I should be able to play decent rhythm guitar with or without. The King Cole Trio was great in that Oscar Moore played slightly amplified rhythm, so I could do that. So you had to have a good rhythmic feel, whatever that means. And I would say really to fit in was so important. I played a lot, especially when I was in my early teens, I played in a lot of groups where there was no bass fiddle, no string bass. And a lot of times there'd be drums, accordion, clarinet and guitar, that sort of thing. So,
what a strange combination!
It seems so, though, doesn't it? It was pretty usual. I remember when I heard my first string bass, and I couldn't get over that. I said, "Wow, what is that? Low." I'm not sure. I guess playing good, fitting in, making whatever situation. But this goes for any instrument, though. So let's see. I'll try to narrow it down. Rhythm playing was important in small groups and also in big bands. Being able to read music, for me anyway, was important, the kind of jobs that I had. And then to have an amplifier so that one could play a melody occasionally or a solo if you were allowed to. The amp was still relatively a new thing, I think. And this was in the 1930s, early 40s. So I think Charlie Christian had kind of made the amp part of the vocabulary. I hadn't really thought of that before, but I hope I did it okay.
I'm wondering, too, if there were any things that were expected of you as the guitarist in the band early in your career that you didn't think really suited you.
Singing? Singing, dancing. I can't dance.
Was the guitarist expected to dance?
I don't really know. Playing loud, I guess. I'm still not sure why. I never was able to I tried to kind of blend in all the time. And, playing fast. There you are. There's one. I said, anybody asked me to play fast, I'm going home. And I still feel like that.
Well, why is that?
I think it's partly my makeup, my personality makeup. I tend to take a long view of things as I'm, even if I'm just walking down the street, I tend to gawk around and look at things, and it's hard for me to move fast or to think fast. I'm not thinking terribly fast at the moment. But yeah, I'd rather play something with a nice groovy feeling to it than play I Got Rhythm real fast. Mm-hmm. Or giant steps. I sort of make a kind of joke that on the subways where it says handicapped seating, I'm allowed to sit there because of the way I play giant steps. Anybody asked me to move, I said, have you heard me play giant steps?
Oh, that's funny. Now, Pat Metheny, when you were first starting to play, what was expected of you as the guitarist in the band? And did you ever feel anybody ever expected you to, like, play fast like Tal Farlow or get Wes Montgomery sound before you knew what the Pat Metheny sound was and, you know, who you were, what your real identity was as a player?
Well, I was lucky to be around musicians in Kansas City who actively discouraged that, who, when you would play something that sounded like Wes Montgomery, instead of saying, wow, that's great that you sounded like Wes Montgomery, they would kind of diss you for it. And that is something that has really changed just between my generation and the generations that have followed, is that now it's kind of okay if you sound like somebody else. Hardly anybody even questions it anymore. It's just kind of part of the thing. For me, I really came up, even though I feel very strongly indebted to Wes and Jim as well, whenever I find myself doing overtly Jim kinds of things or Wes kinds of things, I don't see it as a good thing. I don't see it as a, oh, that's success. To me, that's like, you know, I should try not to do that, you know. And, you know, that's something I always attribute to, you know, some guys that I was around in Kansas City who always, you know, made sure to let me know that jazz is the music of individuals and of people finding their own voice and their own way of playing and their own way of looking at music. Mm-hmm, you know, I've always been around, luckily been around musicians who really kind of put that in no uncertain terms. You know, I've mentioned Gary Burton a few times. He's a strong individual kind of player. I was lucky to be around Ornette Coleman quite a bit, who is probably the most individual of individuals, you know, when it comes to defining your own way of thinking about music. And that's always been very important to me. Even though I've embraced a lot of different things stylistically, I always try to do it from a real personal point of view.
My guests are guitarist Jim Hall and Pat Metheny. They have a new CD of duets. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Pat Metheny and Jim Hall, and they have a new CD of guitar duets. I've asked you each to choose records that you think show off the other to good effect on the new CD. Pat Metheny, I'd like to ask you to choose one of your favorite Jim Hall tracks from Jim Hall's whole body of work, perhaps a track that greatly influenced you when you were coming of age.
I would pick the track My Funny Valentine on the Jim Hall, Bill Evans record, Undercurrent. Jim's solo on that is just a classic and certainly influenced not just me, but now a bunch of generations of musicians.
Well, why don't we hear the solo from that? That's Jim Hall with Bill Evans from their album Undercurrents. My guests are Jim Hall and Pat Metheny, who have a new duet CD. Jim Hall, let me ask you to choose one of your favorite tracks by Pat Metheny from his body of work.
It's interesting. I can't really choose a specific track, but I love the whole CD, the Secret Story CD. I love the composition on that, and I love the idea of it. And for me, with Pat, it's a whole, each CD is kind of a composition in itself, and that was, I would say, my favorite.
Pat Metheny, would you like to narrow it down from that recording?
Let me think what would be a good one from that record. Think about that. That's such a compositional record.
Yeah.
It's like you say, it's kind of one long thing. Maybe at the very end of that record, there's one tune called Tell Her You Saw Me, that's a ballad that's real pretty. That might be a good one.
Sounds good to me. Let's hear it. That's Pat Metheny, and my guests are guitarist Pat Metheny and Jim Hall. They have a new duet CD. How did you each know that guitar was it for you, that it wasn't going to be about trumpet or clarinet or piano, it was guitar?
In my case, I had an uncle, my Uncle Ed, in kind of hillbilly Ohio, who played the guitar and sang kind of like Willie Nelson stuff. And I'm again inferring like 100 years later, but I think I kind of looked up to him. He also always had cute ladies around him, so that was that was another incentive. But he played the guitar, and then my mom got me a guitar when I was 9, I think. But the interesting or ironic or whatever part of it for me is that I quickly realized that I the instrument that I really hear more than the guitar even is maybe the tenor saxophone. I hear someplace between a tenor saxophone and a piano. So even though I'm playing the guitar, I think my hearing or my psyche or whatever is more attuned to wind instruments. So it was kind of a split there.
Have you ever played one?
No, I played piano a bit in to get through music school. But I played with some great saxophone players. I was really fortunate that way, starting with Ben Webster and then Sonny Rollins, of course. And then Paul Desmond, I worked with Paul a lot. And now I work with Greg Osby. Speaking of individuals, he's determinedly individual.
He sure is.
Yeah.
So what do you think it is about, say, saxophones that carries over into your playing? I mean, it's not the rhythm part. There's no, like, rhythm saxophone. What is it about the tone or?
Yeah, in the case of the tenor saxophone, it's the register of it, I think, and the breath of it, the fact that you can play a note really long and make it sustain. Mm-hmm. The fact that you can hear picking sounds when a guy plays a saxophone. So I especially when I was with Jim Jufri, Jimmy would get after me if he heard lots of picking in something that he had written. So I'd try to figure out a saxophone way of playing it. So I guess it's the breath and the expressiveness that's possible on a wind instrument, and I try to get that out of the guitar. And in a certain sense, I use the amplifier to play softer, in that if I'm playing with an amplifier, I can hit the string softer, I can use a softer gauge string and still have it project. Whereas if I were playing an acoustic guitar, I'd really kind of have to bang on it to project.
So do you think you use the amplifier too to get some of the sustain and legato that a horn mm-hmm. player could easily get?
Yeah, exactly.
And Pat Metheny, how did you know that guitar was it for you?
Well, I'm from a family of trumpet players, and I, in fact, started on trumpet myself when I was about 8. My older brother Mike is an excellent trumpet player, kind of who was almost like a child prodigy around the Kansas City area, playing concerts and stuff, starting when he was, you know, very young. And my dad is a good trumpet player. My grandfather was a professional trumpet player his whole life, played under John Philip Sousa, and you know, it's just a natural thing to play the trumpet. Jim mentioned that when he first met me, I had braces on my teeth, which I did for almost 4 years, and that made playing the trumpet excruciatingly painful. And besides that, I wasn't a natural trumpet player the way my brother was, and I was constantly being compared to him, you know, because he was, you know, this kind of sensation. So, and, you know, the thing of the Beatles and the guitar and all that stuff happening, you know, as a cultural phenomenon, definitely got my attention as well. And also, the last thing in the world my parents wanted me to do was play the guitar, which at age 11 was like throwing gasoline on a fire as my desire for the guitar increased. So I just kind of gravitated towards it for probably not musical reasons at the beginning. But once I sort of found myself in the midst of it and started to hear some of the music that had been played on the instrument in jazz, it seemed like a kind of open-ended place to be. You know, I have to admit that I hear trumpet in my head. I mean, my favorite musicians in many cases are trumpet players, especially Miles Davis and Freddie Hubbard. Those are kind of my two real models with Clifford Brown not far behind, for especially for phrasing details. And I still love trumpet players, and I have to admit, when I'm playing, I'm thinking trumpet in a lot of ways, even in terms of breathing and fingering and everything. But the guitar has something else in its flexibility that's real special.
You mentioned breathing. You know, breathing as if you were playing trumpet. When you're playing a wind instrument, you really have to know where to breathe, and you have to breathe in a musical place. Theoretically, when you're playing guitar, no one will know when you're breathing, but do you still have to figure out where you're going to breathe?
It's funny. I hold my breath while I'm playing, and when I take a pause, in the line, I breathe. And I've always done that. And it's just a subconscious thing for me that comes from starting out as a trumpet player, I think.
And Jim, do you find that too?
Yeah, that's actually a terrific question. I realized Pat and I recorded before this duet album. Pat did one track on an album of mine. We played Django with a group of strings, and we both played acoustic guitars, and the microphone was close to my head, and I could hear myself not only breathing but singing. It's a pretty disgusting sound, actually, but I know that I was breathing. I sound like I'm ordering food from the booth, kind of. I do, and I more than I knew, even, I guess I sing everything that I play, or attempt to sing it, at least. So, yes, I am breathing, too.
On your new CD of duets, the Jim Hall Pat Metheny CD, there are two standards, All the Things You Are and Summertime. I'm wondering how you each see the place of standards in your own music. Jim Hall, you've recorded a lot of standards over the years.
I have. It's a good question, because I still love to play body and soul. But I've played it, I don't know, zillions of times, and I have a low boredom threshold, I think. So I usually, in every set of music that I do, I play probably one standard, usually a ballad, although All the Things You Are can be either a ballad or zippy. I think Pat and I did it in 3/4 on this thing. But standard tunes from the era that, what I kind of call the golden age of American popular music, Jerome Kern and Gershwin and people like that, Harold Arlen. The shapes of those things are just gorgeous. All the Things You Are has a gorgeous shape to it, a marvelous melody with great arrival points and surprises. And I think they're terrific models for both for composition and for improvisation. So I just think they're beautifully put together, and they shouldn't be forgotten. And they have influenced the tunes have actually influenced my playing and influenced my writing.
Pat Metheny, you don't do songs as much, you know, like standard songs from the repertoire.
You know, it's funny, I kind of grew up playing all those songs, as most guys do, you know, just because it is such an essential part of the language, and there's sort of no better way to get an understanding or to develop an understanding of harmony than those songs. I mean, it's, you know, a song like All the Things You Are is just, like Jim said, it's such a perfect model, and it's such a great sort of foundation to build things on that. You know, like everybody, I started out learning those songs, playing those songs. The thing with me is that I just haven't recorded that many, mainly because when I started making records, I thought, okay, well, I'm probably only going to get to make one or two records in my life. So I better try to, you know, get my own thing in there and try to develop my own music and my own tunes and all that sort of thing. And now that I look back on having made, you know, I don't know, 20-some records at this point, and I see how little I've really recorded those kinds of songs, and how in many ways that's the stuff that I know the best because I've played it the longest. You know, I probably do need to spend more time, you know, coming up with ways of playing those songs that I could put on record. I mean, the thing I like about the way we did both All the Things You Are and Summertime on this record is that we didn't just plan. We kind of came up with a way of presenting mm-hmm. them that's pretty unique, actually. All the Things You Are, especially just through the improvisational aspect of it, because we just kind of use it as a starting place for I don't even know what we did on there. We go all over the place, rhythmically and melodically, harmonically, too. Summertime, it's a pretty different kind of treatment of that tune than I think I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Well, Pat Metheny, Jim Hall, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been great,
Terry. Thanks.
Jim Hall and Pat Metheny have a new CD of duets on Telarc Jazz. Coming up, music critic Milo Miles on Brazilian singer Caetano Veloso. This is Fresh Air. Brazilian singer-songwriter Caetano Veloso is on his first extended American tour. He has a new CD called Livro. In Brazil, Veloso has been a major pop star since the 1960s. Music critic Milo Miles went to Caetano's concert in Lowell, Massachusetts on Saturday. Before we hear his review, let's hear a track from the new CD.
Vem, eu vou pousar a mão no teu quadril. Multiplicar-te os pés por muitos mil. Fita o céu, roda a dor. Define nossa vida toda. Mas esses passos dançam moda e dirão ao mundo por onde ir.
It was a wise move to book Caetano Veloso into the Lowell Memorial Auditorium for only his second performance in the Boston area. The thriving Brazilian community of Lowell ensured that the 3,000-seat hall was more than 80% sold out. And sometimes it seemed everyone knew all the words to the 20-plus songs in the two-hour show. But any non-Brazilian could hear that Caetano Veloso is the child of Bob Dylan, the Beatles, and 1960s pop modernism. He simply expects that his songs can be about any subject he chooses, can be frankly literary, and can incorporate styles from bossa nova to Afro-funk to 12-tone classical. For a near contemporary of the Beatles, Veloso is remarkably vibrant and forward-looking. His recent album, Livro, is one of the year's richest and most intelligent. Even more remarkable, Veloso and his musical director, Jacques Morlenbaum, assembled a crack 11-piece band capable of putting all the music across. Veloso did several of his sweet and catchy oldies with just voice and guitar. Otherwise, he used four percussionists on a host of drums and rattles to hold everything together in webs of rhythm, the way some American popsters use string sections for harmonic unity. On the Livro album, his young son's song, How Beautiful Could a Bean Be, is a cutesy throwaway. In concert, Veloso made it into a captivating showpiece for his band members to show off their dance steps. Best of all, he took the oddest, most experimental tune from the album, yes, the one that mixes 12-tone classical and dance rhythms, and delivered it so forcefully it became the tune that got people dancing in the aisles. The rapport between Veloso and his confirmed fans showed the pleasures of playing to the community. But Brazilian pop fans are divided about Veloso, much as North Americans are about classic rock idols. Some obsessives pore over Veloso's every gesture, every outfit he wears on stage, as though these were clues from a sacred text. Others, mostly youngsters, think the old self-important loudmouth should just fade away. But for me, seeing Veloso for the first time, I got an inkling of how fans from, say, Japan feel when they encounter venerable Anglo-American rock stars. I could take what I liked about Veloso's lyricism, appreciate how vibrant his voice was in person. Unlike Brazilians, I didn't have to deal with his long history, take a life-or-death stand on him, deal with the weight of being in his fan community. It was fun. A little strange, but fun.
Milo Miles is music editor for Rock.com. Caetano Veloso's new album, Livro, is on the Nonesuch label. He performs in Washington, D.C. tomorrow and in Miami on Saturday.
A Bahia, estação primeira do Brasil.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Chirac. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Que alegria não ter sido em vão.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Legacy, a biography of Moses and Walter Annenberg by Christopher Ogden, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Donald Goldsmith talks about the future of space exploration and colonization. His new book is called Voyage to the Milky Way. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.